I'm Dan Runcy, the host and founder of Trapital, and today's episode is my conversation with the chairman and CEO of Def Jam, Tunji Balogun. This is a conversation that Tunji and I have been circling for a while, so I'm glad that we're able to have it live in person and on stage. He's been at the helm now at Def Jam for almost 3 years, and a lot's changed in the music industry, and a lot's changed about how people think about hip-hop, one of the genres that Def Jam has been primarily known for in its 40-year run. So Tunji and I talk about how it's been for him so far, what it's been like navigating some of the changes that have happened with Universal Music Group over the past couple years, and how he thinks about genres and his role as a creative leading a company like Def Jam. He no longer wants the company to be defined by its past, which I think can be common for a lot of brands and labels in music that have a strong legacy. But how do we think forward? How do we push things forward? So Tunji talks a lot about that, what he brought with him from his RCA days and more. Really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too. Let's dive in. This episode of Trapital is brought to you by Splice, a creative platform for musicians and producers. Celebrating human creativity with powerful workflow tools for sound discovery, Splice is home to the world's leading catalog of sounds and samples. Splice is an essential tool for music creators, fueling the top 100, and can be heard in some of 2024's biggest hits. Subscribe today and elevate your music production. And now, to switch gears a bit, we're going to talk about the state of hip-hop. And I'm proud to be joined by my guy, the chairman and CEO of Def Jam Recordings, Tunji Balogun. You and I were at dinner last night. We're just talking about how the first time we connected, you reached out to me. This is back when you were at RCA. You reached out to me, and the title of the email was called "Don't Call It a Comeback." Here we are, almost 4 years later, and you come out to a song that is one of the biggest hits from the record label that you are now the CEO of.
Crazy, yeah. Synergistic, I would say. Serendipitous.
So let's talk about that, because you've now been at the helm for 3 years leading Def Jam. Is the job what you thought it was going to be?
I would say yes and no. I mean, I knew it would be very challenging, but you know, you can never predict the ebbs and flows of the industry and the things that are going to change as you walk through the door. So I would say I knew it would be the most challenging thing I've ever done, and I knew it would be very much a combination of like creative and strategy. But yeah, there's been twists and turns that have happened that no one could have predicted. So I'll say I was prepared to be challenged, but I didn't exactly know what those challenges would be. But I'm enjoying it, actually. I'm like, I feel like I'm in my groove. The first year was like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing and I'm trying to figure it out. Second year, I feel like I started to kind of like get my weight up, and now I feel like I know what I'm doing. I know the direction I'm heading in, and I'm confident. I will say there was a lot of imposter syndrome. Being a little on the younger side for a job like this, being one of the few Black people doing it, I knew I could have success, but I think I had to sort of like get in the role and like really spend some time before I felt like, okay, I know what the hell I'm doing every day.
Let's talk about that mindset that you were in when this opportunity came up, because I'd read in a recent interview where you said this is a tough decision for you. And if you look at it on paper, this is a role that one of the most legendary rappers has had. This is a role that other artists that you and I know have publicly campaigned for to have this role. And that was a tough decision for you. Why?
It was tough because of two reasons. Number one, because I feel like I had a really great base that I was working from at RCA and a lot of amazing artists that I was in a rhythm with and had found a lot of success with. So, and, you know, anytime you leave people that have become family, you know, that's tough. But it was also tough because it is such a treasured and like storied kind of role. And, you know, you got to live up to the role once you step into the seat. So also it's like, it's such a East Coast hip hop kind of storied role. And, you know, I'm like a West Coast R&B pop Afro beats guy. Right. So I was thinking, I was like, are people going to understand and give me the support? But I mean, my career really started in the hip hop space, but I would say most of the successful artists that I've worked with and success stories that I've been a part of, you know, are kind of more in the R&B space or a little bit of left of center hip hop or Afro or pop or stuff like that. So I was second guessing it. I'm also like such a nerdy historian of the game that I knew what it was like for LA when he went in. And I knew that he kind of faced some of those challenges because he was seen as an R&B pop guy who wasn't from New York. And, you know, that's part of the reason why he ended up working with Jay, and to get that credibility and to make sure that that world was like, okay, yeah, he knows what he's doing. So, you know, I was thinking about all that stuff and thinking about the historical context and all that stuff. So I've always been an outsider in the music industry, and I'm proud of that. And I feel like that's a big part of the reason why I've been able to have success. You know, I think I was like internalizing that a little bit. Like, am I too much of an outsider for this role? You know, I don't live in New York. I live in LA. You know what I mean? Are people going to accept that? But, you know, I realized that in order for me to be the best version of myself, I had to just step into it with confidence. And like, you know, I couldn't move because like I'm strongest here in LA. So I was like, we're just going to have to mold it and figure it out in real time. And I feel like we've been doing that. So still a work in progress, but I feel good about where we're at now.
It's like there's this persona of this 55-year-old man in Timberland boots. That's like, hey.
Oh, my goodness.
You?
It's funny because a lot of those people they're on my line. They're like hitting me up like, yo, this is perfect for Def Jam. And I'm like, in 1989, yeah. But like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you got to evolve, you got to move forward. And that's actually one of the beauties of the label to me is like, it's always evolved and it's always kind of been at the cutting edge of Black music and where Black music is going. And that's one of my favorite things about being a fan of the label. Like, the label's 40 years old this year. I'm 41. So I literally like, I'm the first person to run it who grew up listening to everything and grew up on the classics of the label. So, you know, if you go back and you retrace steps in the beginning, it was New York hip hop because that was what was at the forefront and cutting edge of Black music at the time. But if you look historically, the sound was always expanding. You know, obviously, as you get into the late 80s and the 90s, it's hip hop from around the country. You know, I remember like when I was in elementary school, it was like Warren G and Montel Jordan were like West Coast artists who were signed to Def Jam. And then as you progress like into the LA era, it's more pop, it's more R&B, you know, and then to the point where you get to like Justin Bieber and Alessia Cara, who are very, very different from where the label started, but they all kind of like, you know, the definition of what a Def Jam artist should be, I think, has expanded over time. And now, you know, in my era, like we're pushing into Afrobeats, we're pushing into dancehall. I'm really trying to like epitomize the global sound of Black music. And that doesn't mean that the artists have to all be Black, obviously, because it's like, if I find a Beastie Boys, I'm going to sign them. If I find a Justin Bieber, I'm going to sign them. It has to retrace back to the origins of the label. But I also feel like we got to push forward and do some new stuff and, you know, really try to stay at that cutting edge of music. Before I was an executive, I was a fan, right? I always try to keep that mindset. And before I was an executive, I was also an artist. And honestly, like all this music industry stuff, it's really about the fans and the artists, right? So if we remove ourselves and remove the ego of like, okay, we have these titles and these jobs or whatever, like it's really about respecting the fans, respecting the artists, and doing the work to connect them, you know, the most organic and real ways. So,
and on that note too, once we get past the labels, I feel like the label you probably identify most with is being a creative, being someone that is true in that perspective and a creative as opposed to someone that may come more from the business side. And when you look at the leadership at Def Jam over the years, you've seen that shift. You've seen how certain leaders took it one way, certain leaders took it another way. And how has that been for you as a creative where the business hasn't necessarily been led by a creative in some time?
I really just wanted to come in and be the best version of myself. I didn't want to like mold or change my strategy that had been working for a decade before I got the job. Like for me, it was always like identify really amazing acts, you know, give them the support. And usually I would discover these acts really early and just surround them with ideas and resources and, you know, try to bring people to them that could help them reach their vision faster. And that was how, you know, most of my successful campaigns and artists at RCA or Interscope before that, you know, that came from me really just being a fan, a nerdy fan that found things early, reached out early, helped out. And then when it was time for the artist to do a deal, you know, a lot of them would sign to me because they're like, well, you reached out when nobody cared and I had two songs out and you cared and you helped me. So I came into this role with the same ethos, the same mindset, to really take it back to artist development and to really roll up my sleeves and do the work. You know, there hadn't been a lot of new successful acts at the label for a few years before I got here. So for me, I was like, well, we gotta find some new acts and we gotta like really dig deep to find special artists who are telling unique stories. And obviously we have to stay true to what the label stands for. I feel like Def Jam is one of the few labels that actually has a point of view and like kind of means something very specific in the marketplace. So it's important to like bring in new acts that epitomize that and again can like help us, you know, come into the next 40 years of the label.
You talked about artist development and how key that is, because if the label hasn't broken acts, you need to do that. But you're also a label that has pressures of market share, and everyone's looking to see where were you at this quarter, where were you at that half of the year. How do you balance those, knowing that artist development can take time despite those metrics that you're being evaluated on?
Market share, it's a measurement that people use in the industry to denote who's doing well or whatever. But for me, market share comes from revenue and sales, and the sales come from breaking new artists and obviously like having your big artists come back and drop albums. But really, there's no market share without developing new acts and breaking them. So to me, I'm like, I'm just looking at the beginning of the equation and not quite the end of it. And I know that if we invest and take the time to break new acts, and then we have our veterans come back with, you know, their new albums and the new campaigns, that'll just come out of thin air. It'll happen. I've seen it happen. I saw it happen when I went to RCA. And where the market share was when I started and where it ended was very different, because we broke 15 new acts in, you know, 7-8 years. And that's how you continue to push forward. But I'm definitely not the person who wakes up in the morning and is thinking about market share. Like, that is not my approach at all. Not to say that I don't respect that approach, but that's just not the best way for me to be a great executive. Like, for me, it's like, it's about the songs, it's about the artists, it's about really pushing through with campaigns that are distinct. And I also feel like there are a lot of lanes that are open right now in music, especially in Black music. Like, so for me, I'm like, let's try to rebuild some of these lanes. Let's invest in artists that are doing something new and original. And if you do the work and deliver, all that stuff will come. Those numbers will come. The market share will come. I've seen it happen throughout my career. So that's kind of my approach to it.
I hear that. Let's talk a bit about hip hop specifically and where we are right now, because you took the role over around 3 years ago. We've heard and seen more and more headlines about where hip hop is. On one hand, you have people that have complained about why it may be tougher to break certain acts. We've also seen a decline in terms of the revenue compared to other genres. But as you and I know, there's a lot of nuance in a lot of the way that data is reported. Certain artists that get priorities for things that may lead to having more sales versus others. And the tough thing is that even though you may know a lot of that nuance, that doesn't impact some of the investment decisions, some of the focus, and some of the opportunity to look at things. So because you've now been in this role where a lot of this is happening, how has that been to navigate?
Like you said, it's very nuanced and it depends on how you look at it. I mean, I also feel like we're in this era where like genres are kind of ephemeral and artists fit into multiple categories, right? And even if the artist isn't considered to be a hip hop artist, many of these other genres or many of these other sounds are borrowing the style or the swag from hip hop. So there are country artists who are full on rapping over 808 beats. You know, there are K-pop artists that are like spitting bars in their songs, and they're not categorized as hip hop, but to me, they are definitely borrowing from the essence of hip hop. So I feel like sometimes when the people say, oh, you know, hip hop is declining, I'm like, I still hear the sound and I still see the swag in all these other artists and genres. Not only that, I think it's becoming more international. So it's like, perhaps American hip hop is slightly off, but a lot of the international rappers are growing and a lot of these international scenes are growing. I also feel like when you look at these other markets, every market has a rap scene now. Not every market, but a lot of these international markets have their own rap scene. So if I'm a kid in Germany, I'm probably going to listen to some German rappers in addition to the American rappers who I love. Or like my 15-year-old niece who lives in Oregon, her favorite rapper is Central C. Central C and Kendrick, I think. So, you know, again, it depends on the perspective that you're taking, because in my opinion, I think people are listening to the same amount of hip hop as they always have. I just think that maybe sometimes those artists are not identified as hip hop artists, or maybe they're not considered to be maybe part of the American rap scene or whatever. But you can see and hear and feel the presence of it throughout damn near every genre of music, you know, including other Black genres of music like R&B. And, you know, I think it's present. Like my favorite dance producer is K-Tronada, and you know, he dips into hip hop, R&B, Afro, dancehall. Like, there's really the borders around genre and music are to me slowly disintegrating. And I think that's ultimately a good thing. Like, I don't think people should be bound by genre. Like, and most of the biggest artists that I've worked with have spoken to multiple audiences. You know, for example, like Khalid spoke to the pop audience and the R&B audience. Doja Cat spoke to the hip hop audience and the pop fans. Bryson Tiller was R&B and hip hop. you know, or someone like Tems, R&B and Afrobeat. So to me, it's like these strict kind of guidelines to me are just slowly kind of coming down. So,
and I think that is the piece that sometimes gets lost, because you hear the high level statement and then people start asking all these questions about hip hop. But to your point, when I hear an Ariana Grande song, I hear hip hop production. We could talk about Bad Bunny or other artists that get labeled by where they're from and not necessarily the genre of music. And to be honest, it's always been this way. You look at rock music back in the 90s. I don't know if anyone saw this, but there was this funny clip that was on Twitter or TikTok a couple weeks ago where they took the guy from Rage Against the Machine. They took out the background of the vocals and they put some church hymns behind him. And it sounded like he was like at a sermon in gospel, because like that's the way that so many of us have listened to music, taken it in. And I wonder, though, obviously you see that nuance. Do you feel like the people that work throughout the industry agree with that and say, yes, even though how you're labeling this may be in decline, it really isn't, because you still hear the influence everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I hope people are looking at it critically and not just like this black and white thing where it's like, if you rap, you're a hip hop artist. It's like, I don't know. Like, and then there are artists that kind of shift between genres. Like, we met Post Malone as a rapper and he just put out a country album. Like, I don't know. Like, at the end of the day, is it amazing? Or is it not? I don't think that the new generation of listeners is that inured to genre. Like, you know, I'll mention my niece again. Half of her playlist, she doesn't even understand. You know, she's listening to K-pop, Latin music, Afro beats, a little bit of American hip hop. But she's like, yo, I don't even understand this K-pop stuff, but I love it. And I'm like, you know, when I was 15, if I heard a rapper with an accent, I turned it off immediately. I was like, turn this shit off. Like, I don't even want to hear this. And I feel like the new generation of listeners is just a little bit more open-minded. They're extremely connected digitally, and they are not phased by new sounds. So I think those of us in the industry, it's like you're still trying to uphold these formats and these genres, and it's like, yo, like, I don't know if the artists or the fans, who are way more important than us at the end of the day, are looking at it the same way. So I think we got to evolve and we got to meet those people where they are, you know.
You talked a lot about fans and artists and being able to connect with them. Are there things that you do in your leadership role to stay connected to where the fans are and stay connected to understanding that relationship and that dynamic?
Yeah, I'm still outside, you know? I'm not like in an ivory tower somewhere, unreachable, waiting for people to come and deliver the future to me. I was the youngest CEO until 2 days ago. Shout out to Elliot. I've always been kind of a hybrid. And like I said, I've always been an outsider. I don't see this role as like, oh, I'm like looking down on the people. Like, I'm still one of the people. I'm still at the show. I'm still in the club. You know, I'm still connected to the creative community in a way that, to me, kind of gives me a different approach and perspective. And I also feel like specifically Def Jam is a very different label than most of these other labels. So I don't necessarily want it to be run or want it to feel like a typical major label. To me, it should be at the forefront. It should be different. It should be progressive. So for me, yeah, I like to experience. I like to be outside. I like to go to shows. I like to be in the studio. Like, that's my natural habitat. I'm much more comfortable in the studio than I am like in a board meeting talking about financial analysis. You know what I mean? Like, my natural habitat is in the field with the artists, with the producers, the songwriters. And that's, I think, why I've been able to become such a great connector, because I can translate. I can go to the finance meeting and I can go to the black market flea and run around and see my people. And I can sort of bring those people together and make things happen and bring opportunities to both sides that make sense for both sides. So, like I said, my approach is different and I take pride in that, because I don't necessarily like want to be a carbon copy of what everyone else is doing. And I don't think that we should be.
What are you most proud of so far in your tenure?
I mean, I would say I'm proud of my team, because I feel like we have a very young and diverse team, and, you know, very intentionally want our team to be a reflection of the creative community, of the artist community. And I also feel like, you know, all the young, the kids in their 20s who are on my team, like, they're more connected to that fan experience and that artist experience than someone like me. You know, this is my 20th year in the industry, which is crazy. So I'm proud that we've been able to empower like a new set of executives that can push us into the future. I also say, you know, I'm proud of the artists that we've signed in my tenure who have found success. I'm nowhere near where I want it to be, but, you know, whether it's like a Coco Jones or Money Long or Friday or some of the new acts that you guys may not have heard of, I do feel like we're stepping into the next generation
of great Black artists and artists who are making Black music. And, you know, that's the job is like, can we honor the past of the label and stay true to what the label means? But also, can we step into the future and do some new shit
and have it live up to the greatness of what came before? So, yeah, that's my double answer.
And do you feel like you have the leeway to do most of the things that you would want to be able to do at the label? And the reason I ask that is because I'm sure in this room, there's many people that, you know, want to see you succeed in this role. We've also seen how the leadership structures and things have impacted other labels that are known for Black music historically. So how is it for you? You're a creative. You want to do different things. I know you want to push the envelope, go beyond just hip hop, go to some other genres. Are you empowered to do those things?
Hell yeah. I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't made sure that I would have my runway and the time. Because we're now in an era where, you know, it takes at least 3 years to fully break a new act, right? Sometimes it takes 7 years. Sometimes it takes 10 years. So I knew that if I was going to do this without chasing algorithms and chasing data, if I was going to do this with real artists, it's going to take time. I'll agree. I'll do it if you guys actually allow me the time and the space to be imaginative and run in some new directions. So I do feel like I've had that, but, you know, like I said, it takes time. It takes at least 3 years to fully get there. All the artists who broke this year, have been around for years. Whether it's Chapel, Sabrina, Shaboozy, even the Tommy Richmond, like all these artists have been around for mad long. I heard Shaboozy's music in 2017, 2018. Ironically, I actually met him in this room, Grammy Week. Or, you know, this is Sabrina Carpenter's sixth album. You know what I mean? Like Tommy Richmond was on Brent's album a year before he had a song that blew up. So obviously there's all this, like, you know, Troy talked about it a little bit. There's like all this like TikTok stuff and data stuff. And every week there is a new artist that's poking through with a random meme or an algorithm that everybody starts chasing after. And for me, it's like I've always just like looked for things that were really special that made me feel like a fan again. And then I'm like, I'm going to sign this and I'm just going to take the time to really like tell the story the right way. And some artists break faster than others. You know, I've gotten lucky a couple of times, like when I signed Bryson or when I signed Khalid, like their first song just like blew up. It wasn't Bryson's first song, but the first song that I worked on with him went crazy. Khalid, literally the first couple songs he came out with blew the fuck up. Doja Cat, I met in 2013. She didn't break until 2018. Or like someone like Gambino. Like I met Gambino super early when people didn't even take his music seriously. And it took him years to get that credibility and to kind of gather all the different parts of his fan base under one tent to where people were like, oh yeah, this is obvious. This guy's out of here. I told Lucien, and you know, same conversation I had like when we did the restructure with the Republic guys, it was like, I'm really like a person who wants to find the greatest thing in the world, roll up my sleeves, and take the time to build it. So if this is going to be successful, we got to do it that way. Every now and then, you know, we'll go after something that is just like a data thing, but only if it's a real artist. Because I've seen it happen the other way. I've seen people sign an artist, have this big moment because the song or this, you know, it's like a video of like a dog or something that goes viral and everyone's like, oh my God, let's go get it. You sign the artist, song does okay, song does well. And then it's like, okay, what the fuck are we going to do next? And then the artist is like, well, I don't really got no songs. You know, I've never done an interview or a show. I have to learn how to do those things. And for me, I'm like, I'd rather start from scratch with something great, really dig in and tell a unique story. And it might take a little bit longer, but that artist is going to last longer. That artist is going to be more educated. That artist is going to be more equipped for the moment. That artist will probably have a better team because they're not scrambling to catch a moment. It's more so like, let's build something real and let's take the time to, you know, let's invest the time and the energy and the effort to tell a story. And we are in an era where it takes a little bit longer to do that. And there used to be buttons that you could push that would make it instant. And now it's like 1,000 little things that you have to coordinate in real time to get it right. So that's what we spend most of our time doing. It's like, okay, we found this great thing. What are the 1,000 things that we need to do over the next 2-3 years to tell the story and to bring the fans to this artist and to make it feel important and, you know, and to stay true to who that artist is? I always tell new artists and their teams, like, it's not just about the things that we do. It's also about the things that we don't do, the things that we shield you from, the things that we don't even bring to you because we know that they don't make any sense for who you are or where you're trying to get to. And it's not just about like, oh, let's go do the biggest look every single time. Because sometimes the biggest look is too early to do it. Doesn't make sense for the artist. Maybe we do it on the next album. You know, it's really about taking those measured steps and being so in lockstep creatively with your artist that you know before they know whether it's the right move to make, you know?
a lot of that, what you just said there, reminds me of this quote that you had had in an interview where you said part of your vision with this role is to make sure that Def Jam is defined by its future and not nostalgia. And it's exactly those things you're saying. It's the artist development. It's taking time. It's, yeah, knowing that you may have to have some data things here and there, but also looking at the artists that blew up this year, like you said, it's not like they came out of nowhere. These are artists that have been doing it. I think Sabrina's on her sixth album. Like, it takes time to do all this.
She was good. It just wasn't her time, you know? I definitely have always been someone who was invested in the future. Like, at any point in my career, whether it was as a fan, as a young artist or whatever, I'm always like, okay, where is this going? When I started signing a lot of R&B acts in 2015, people were just like, R&B's dead. It's been replaced by hip hop. The rappers are singing now. They can do their own hooks. This shit's for old people. And I just met Elias from SoundCloud and I was telling him, you know, I discovered and signed so many artists from SoundCloud just because I was like so deep in the community early. And, you know, I could tell that R&B was going to make a comeback because I started to hear all these new acts on SoundCloud. Some of them weren't even on like major, I guess at the time it was like iTunes really before Apple Music. Spotify was in America, but it wasn't like huge yet. But I could see that it was going in that direction and that there was a community of young listeners. So I ran in that direction. And also, you know, same thing with Afrobeats. You know, my family's from Nigeria, so I was like a little bit ahead of it because my sisters would go to Nigeria, come back and like, you got to hear David or you got to hear Wizkid. And I was able to get ahead of the curve, sign David and sign Wizkid early at a point where people were like, is this going to work? Is this actually going to go global or is it just going to stay on the continent? And I was like, I know it's going to go global because there's a diaspora of young African kids around the world. I'm part of it, who are going to carry this and they're going to bring it to their friends and to their peers. And, you know, again, I'm always down to take the chance on something new, as long as it sounds amazing, you know, as long as the artist and the genre or whatever sounds special, I'll jump in. And I think that's because I'm still a fan. So I'm like, I'm always looking for new sounds, new scenes that excite me. So I'm always going to do that no matter what role I'm in. I feel like that's part of my identity in the industry, is like, okay, that dude is pushing forward. And honestly, that's what Def Jam should be doing. So that's why when the opportunity came, I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take the chance and take the risk and jump in. So 3 years in, you know, we'll see where it goes, but I feel pretty good about where we're at now.
That's what's up. Appreciate you. Tunji Balogun, Def Jam.
Thank you, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.